What is up? What is up? We're actually, honestly, you probably just got done listening to a full segment of this, so me saying what is up is not appropriate. But what is appropriate is me saying we have an amazing special segment with, I think we can both call them cannabis OGs, and some of the most active people on the investment side in multiple fashions. I mean, there's an ETF conversation to have here. I mean, Javier, there's so much to talk about here, but more than anything, I'm just excited to pick their brain.
Very exciting. Very exciting. Should we bring them on? Do you want to introduce
them? Of course. Let's do it. We have the siblings, the power of Poseidon Investment Management with us, Morgan Paxia and Emily Paxia. Let's bring them over. Welcome to Cannabis Insider. How is everybody? Emily, how are you doing today?
Oh, doing fantastic. How are you? And thank you so much for the warm intro.
Oh,
you know, please. When I hear OG, I think, oh, God.
I mean, we're not going to go that far. There's no deity talk here. But I will say we definitely know that there's some original cannabis blood in this chat here. And it's not me. It happens to be the three of you. I'm just here for looks. But Morgan, what's up, man? How's it going?
It's going great. Just got home today. So apologies for the background, but I also just got off a plane. So but I'm glad we were able to do this today. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely.
We know you're busy people and you're doing everything you can to harness the green wave and help people harness the green wave.
Absolutely. So tell us, it was asset management, now it's investment management. Where are we going for here? Let's start with that. Let's start with the quick, small rebrand. Morgan.
Sure. The whole idea of Poseidon has grown quite a bit since 2014 when we first opened our first hedge fund. So since then, we have launched a few other private funds of several SPVs, which are, you know, dedicated vehicles for investing in private companies. Then we launched the ETF. So Poseidon has grown from just a single fund to an institutional asset management platform. Some of these things just have to kind of how you run the organization, it changes some of the things. So the original name is now nested under Poseidon Investment as it relates to that first fund. So that's why we talk about Poseidon Investment Management. We also became an SEC registered firm, as you have to be as a, you know, if you're going to be a advisor or sub-advisor in this capacity on a 40 Act fund being our ETF, but also just from an AUM perspective. From Poseidon's perspective, we've always had this idea of building an institutional firm. And I think taking it to the level of being SEC registered certainly gets to that level. There's very few in our space that are doing it, and brings a whole lot of additional complexities and costs to it. But, you know, it's all in the from our point of view, doing it for the best interest of our investors. So that's a bit of the rebrand. And that's been an evolution over the last, 15, 16 months.
Nice.
That we've really been, making sure that we're now known as Poseidon Investment Management.
And what else goes into this Poseidon Investment Management? I mean, we can go ahead and dive into the ETF, but obviously that's a part of it. And I also want to know, what are your individual roles as siblings? Do you both just take on everything, or what do you focus on specifically? Emily, do you want to start that?
Yeah, I mean, we divvy up responsibilities, but mainly we divvy up portfolio management because, you know, we're very actively involved with our portfolios, even, you know, in as much as we can with public companies to try to, you know, help make introductions to technology platforms or whatever it might be. Or if, you know, we find out someone's trying to sell a single state operator, we'll pass information along, you know, if that's helpful to them, you know, of course, not knowing what happens after that. But it's always just nice to, you know, be involved across the industry and make connections where we can. So we're very busy, but, you know, we do have the private investment funds that we're constantly working with our existing portfolio companies on. We're working with looking at new deal flow for our, you know, some of our strategies to try to understand if there are opportunities that exist out there. And then we're just also constantly monitoring the portfolio. So we split it up pretty well across that. And then we've got different areas that we kind of lean in on in terms of, you know, kind of the administrative aspects of it. Although Morgan does carry a very heavy load on that, and I always appreciate him for it. But we're, you know, very active on all of those things. So we do have a tremendous team across the U.S. We have two guys. We have Colin and Patrick in Boulder. We have Andres in Miami. We have Tyler in New York. We have Lorena. Now she's in Virginia, just outside of D.C. So it's, you know, it's a great team, and it does cover the U.S., which is very helpful from a boots on the ground diligence, meeting with people, meeting with teams, understanding market dynamics. That's very helpful for us as a firm.
Is that normal? Just a quick follow-up before Javi dives in, to have, you know, kind of fun presence all over the country.
No, I would say it was a factor of a few things contributed to it. First, COVID. We were largely based in San Francisco at that time, but then, you know, COVID happened and we were all working remotely anyway for quite a long time, as you probably experienced yourself. But then we also joined forces with Patrick, who was the co-founder of Canopy Boulder, or he was actually the founder and then brought in some colleagues to join him. But he's based in Boulder, and we joined forces on a new strategy, and that was a way that we were able to come together. And it's been great because Colorado, first market ever, it's celebrating its 10th year anniversary of having legalized adult use. I mean, it opened in 2014, but it was legalized in 2012. So pretty tremendous. So it's great to have him there. And then he also brought Colin into the fold, who'd already had experience in the industry working with Urban Grow and was an analyst in his own right, had a deep financial background. But it's great to have him also in Boulder because of his lens of having come from an operating company side and then coming through on the financial side as well. Andres had shifted to Miami, which is where he's from. Andres is interesting because he's a dual citizen U.S. Colombian, actually. And so he spent some time in Bogota with his family and then was in Miami during parts of the pandemic. And then Tyler, as you know, joined us on the ETF. So we've built this team, but it's kind of the new world we're living in to have a disaggregated workforce like this. And it's great because we come together in different markets, but it is really helpful to have the intelligence across the country.
Indeed. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about stocks and public markets, right? Very recently, Canopy announced that it is consolidating all of its U.S. assets into a new holding company to speed up, you know, the implementation of its plans, reduce costs. What do you make of it? How does it impact markets in general? How does it impact Canopy? How does it impact the Poseidon ETF?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a great few weeks of historic moves in our space. And I will give Biden credit for kind of kickstarting some momentum of things to start happening. You know, these things that have been waiting to happen. It's not a coincidence that, you know, since Biden spoke, then we saw the news about GTI and Circle K, and then we saw the news about Canopy. To us, that says this has been a work in progress for quite a while, but waiting to have something that gave them confidence to start moving forward a little bit faster. And that's been very helpful for our industry, or something that's been needed in our industry is the liquidity, right, for things to be moving a bit faster. And in the absence of any kind of visibility of federal reform, it's really slowed things down. So Canopy's announcement, you know, they had been doing this, utilizing their balance sheet from Constellation monies to go and buy U.S. assets, but they couldn't actually buy them or control them. And so it just became this huge depletion of cash off their balance sheet and not getting any credit for it, right, for these performing assets in the U.S. And so I'm sure Constellation has done a tremendous work on this with regulators in the U.S. before green lighting this step forward. Now, there's a lot of time baked into this whole Canopy USA thing. It's not like this is happening overnight. So from our perspective, I just think it's more powerful for what this is going to continue to happen at a faster and larger scale with more strategics coming into the space, you know, just more ways that capital can come in that have largely been held on the sidelines. Last couple of days has been fantastic for Canopy's share price. to us, it's largely meaningless for that, right? I mean, we're looking at fundamentals. We're looking at companies that are going to not just have a stock that'll go up for a couple of days. We're looking at businesses that are going to endure and be, you know, great operations in the next 5 and 10 years. And that's how we look at it with how we're allocating in our ETF and why Canopy is not a part of that. I mean, they have some very structural issues with their operations ex-US. So I think there was very intentional reasons why they started to kind of protect some of these assets. But, you know, outside of Canopy, I just think it's a much bigger implication. You're seeing it from some of the analysts too in our space, talking about how this does start to potentially emerge, what it might look like for some of these US operators to potentially access the listed exchanges. And interestingly enough, though, that's not being reflected in the stock prices really at all. And so, because again, who's rallied the most has been like Canopy or some of the other LPs like Tilray, and much more so than what's happening in the US, which is completely inverse. And that just to us shows how structurally imbalanced the market is right now, because people are buying what they can buy, not buying what will actually get the most benefit from that.
There's two items I'd like to throw into this discussion, the ring here. First is Pablo Zwanich, Cantor Fitzgerald, dropped a note 2 days back regarding how MSOs may be able to start doing the same thing. But then NASDAQ, I believe this morning or yesterday, responded saying they weren't. Basically, this is not okay for Canopy to be doing this. You know, and I don't know what NASDAQ can potentially do there. I honestly don't know. But that being said, does that create an obstacle for these U.S. companies to create a holdings company? And then does NASDAQ block them from listing? I mean, I'd love to get your reactions on both of those thrown in there.
Go ahead, Morgan.
Oh, I'm not surprised to see NASDAQ actually respond that way. I mean, Emily and I, when we saw this news, we're like, how does this possibly resolve, right, in today? And then that's why, again, the way this is structured is it doesn't really happen until what's the earliest, I think, is it Jetty or what's that?
It's at least a year.
It's at least a year. And so there's quite a bit of time in there. And I think they just wanted to start the framing with the understanding that maybe SAFE happens in the lame duck or happens in the next 2 years. But they wanted to start pulling this forward. And that makes a lot of sense to us. I mean, until we get some clarity, until the exchanges have made a position on it, then they're still not going to, you know, they're not going to say that this is okay, right? Because that's a conflicting message, and they have to make sure that they're being consistent. So I'm not surprised to see that. But regardless, I don't want to steal Emily's thunder here, but always talking about how strategics do move faster than regulations can keep up, right? And that's been cannabis's entire life cycle, right? Is we've always been moving, the people move first and then things start to catch up. And in this instance, it's just so much more significant when you're talking about the potential dollars at play, right? Up until this point, it's been largely financed by high net worth and family office. But now when you start to talk about, you know, capital pools in the billions of dollars, I mean, like just as an example, in our ETF today, if you look at the total market cap, just if you were to buy 100% of all the companies in our ETF in PSDN, that would be $15 billion. That's nothing. For an institutional capital pool, that's maybe one fund, like a portion of one fund. Like, I mean, it's the dollars that can come in don't have to be that significant to be so such a huge impact on our space. And, you know, that's why we're seeing it around the fringes first, but those fringes do have some big meaning to it. So it's all coming together. It's just, it's a process and it's time, but we are making some positive strides there. Emily, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I just hope, the way I see things right now is there's all of these pressure points that are starting to build around potentially encouraging the passing of some regulations around banking reform and even capital markets reform, and maybe even putting some pressure on the exchanges to really understand what it would mean to list these companies now. Because the issues I take with this are, when I think about it from a United States standpoint, I've talked about this a lot. This industry is building actual jobs, facilities, creating, it's adding to, you know, it has an economic impact of significance on our United States market. And I think that that should be rewarded by the regulators and by the exchanges. And what I see here is just a ton of capital has flowed to Canada during this time. And if I'm honest, I don't think many of the operators up there have been great shepherds of capital. And I think they've paid themselves first and have not thought really carefully about their shareholders. And I'm not pointing fingers at any one individual in particular, but I do think it has been not a best use of capital. I see a lot more prudence around the allocation of capital in the United States. And that's actually by necessity, because we just have not had the capital available to us as an industry of operators. And so I think it makes people really thoughtful about their deployment. Not everybody. We know some of the stories about the ones that weren't, but we're seeing the consolidation around that at this point. And so I just hope that the folks at the top wake up and look at what they could do, which is enable a U.S.-based industry. And especially when you look at the geopolitical climate that we're facing today, considering what's going on in Europe and the U.K. and even down in Latin America, there's a lot of challenges abroad. China, we're, you know, they're going into lockdown again. Why wouldn't we want to focus on domestic industry that's driving growth here? I can't think of why we wouldn't want to do that. And so I'm just hoping they're going to realize that they should enable this so that we can continue to build this industry, continue to create jobs, and continue to fund, you know, taxes into this country that will be needed, considering what, where we're headed from an economic standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great point. Just a quick on that. I mean, you look at what BAT did with that German operator, you know, that was a sizable investment, and those dollars could have also been allocated here, but they're not. Right, they're being allocated elsewhere, and it's so it's just lost opportunity. And in some aspects, it's almost a positive that the U.S. stocks have not responded as strongly, because it's a to us it's a bit of a message to Congress that you have to act. Like, talk is helpful in that, you know, if, that there's progress being made, but you better follow through with that progress, because the market's really not believing you yet that this is actually happening. And so we, and you know, that's what is definitely on our minds, is we all want to see it, right? We've been through a really tough period, and capital has been super tight. As Emily mentioned, it's made really good companies that, you know, can withstand all of this. But it's also unfortunately, destroyed a lot, many, many more companies, that couldn't make it through this, you know, between the taxes and the regulations, and the lack of progress.
I would love to, you know, go on, discussing markets and politics for forever, but I want to get into the Garden Venture Fund for a little bit. You know, I know you joined forces with a very good friend, Patrick Rea from Canopy Boulder, as you mentioned, and it's been, I understand, very successful so far. You are supporting a lot of female founder companies, which I celebrate, I applaud, and honestly, we're not seeing enough of that. So can you tell us a little bit about the fund, about whether the decision to support all these female founded companies was intentional, or you just were felt drawn to these concepts?
Yeah, I mean, so in investing in an earlier stage the way we are at this time on some of our strategies, we have really looked at where the industry has evolved to. And what it has done is it's illuminated some gaps or some areas that are ripe for disruption. And so that's really kind of where our new focus on this post-seed stage is. You know, we've been looking at new markets that are emerging. The Southeast is very interesting to us. It's hard, but where things are difficult, we can lean in with our experience since, you know, January 2014 of actively managing portfolios. So we're looking on the operating side, but we're also looking on the tech ancillary side. And it's just really exciting to see that female founders have identified where there are opportunity spaces, and some of them have come in with prior experience. And so that's been really encouraging too. But I think that, you know, we've been really happy to see the female founders who've identified those gaps and have really leaned in and are building companies. And, you know, I think our firm in general just tends to have an open aperture about inbounds and introductions. So we do try to really think about the diversity of our portfolio, and that portfolio has diversity just beyond gender. So we're very happy about how that one's coming together, and we're happy to be people who are deploying capital into a diverse universe of founders. And so that is really important to us. But I am really excited about that. And it's funny because we are in a more risk off environment. You've seen some of the routing of the tech stocks, and especially probably coming on the backside of these earnings calls, you know, we've also seen challenges around funding earlier stage companies. But what I'm curious about is how people are thinking about strategies that have a portfolio versus single one-off investments. Because I think in the world where we were in a bull market running hot for about 12 years, you know, you could place capital alongside fund strategies or firms into these syndicates or angel investments or independent individual investments. And you could benefit from kind of the escalator that a lot of these things were on from a valuation standpoint. We are now in a really different world, okay? And even the way the VCs, we've always been marking things, as Morgan and I have just talked about, like on a capital constrained environment, you really have to think about the core metrics of these companies and their path to free cash flow. And in, you know, the Valley, that wasn't always the case. Now everybody's concerned about things we've thought about for years, like gross margins, EBITDA profiles, a path to free cash flow, as I just said. And so I think things are changing. So, you know, in a risk-off environment, you know, I'm not speaking about our strategy in particular, but I think that investors may want to start thinking again about the benefits of strategies with multiple companies in the portfolio, not just one-off investments. And really that gives you the opportunity to experience some of those larger 10 plus X growth stories, but also then when you have to potentially write something off, which we all know you have to do in investing, something always goes to zero, then you're not experiencing a total loss. So I think it's an interesting time to be thinking about these fund or portfolio strategies and for having investors to kind of reopen the door to contemplating that, especially in cannabis with experienced managers who have spent a lot of time understanding this industry and the markets, and we know what corners to look around. So I think it's an interesting time.
You may have just touched on this a bit, but I'd like to double down on this a little bit. And it could be my mistaken perception, which please do correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of female founders operate under asset light models and operate in these brand specific type companies. Is this something that, because there has not been space created for them in these more vertical companies and these more corporate style cannabis companies, that they've found a way into it? Or I'm curious what your response is if my perception is mistaken. And also following that, these asset light businesses seem to have actually been more attractive recently to investors. And I think that's a definite change over this time last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think women are smart and they pay attention, you know, and no, but I do think that, let's face it, the gatekeepers of capital, I was just saying this on my podcast the other day, the gatekeepers of capital have substantially been older white males. And it's no one's fault, but there are familiarity biases, implicit biases, where you tend to kind of lean into a cohort that feels familiar to you, which is other white males. And it's also about connections, right? And so I think that in building these big companies, you have to have access to tens to 20s, hundreds of millions of dollars, right? And I just think that women are still trying to break into that. And this is what I was saying the other day, like, why can't we be gate openers rather than gatekeepers and try to make space for people who come from diverse backgrounds to have access to building, you know, an entrepreneurial endeavor. And I think that, you know, when you look at the data of diversity and women in terms of not just founders, but also the upper level management, those are the teams that tend to show the greater levels of success. But I think to your question, it's a very good one, Patrick, Elliot.
We're the same person. It's fine.
Yeah, you can call me Morgan anytime you want. But, you know, I think that the female founders I know who've gone that approach have just been very wise about, you know, the way that they can build these businesses without having to raise that level of capital, and can plug into these infrastructures that have been costly. And there has been a lot of learning capital into those verticals, by the way. So it's kind of a great time for those types of models to be entering in, and they have a point of view as a brand, and they're able to get a quick lift going. So I think it's a pretty smart move considering how challenging the vertical operator landscape is.
Definitely. And like, even when you can access that those bigger pools of capital, honestly, many of the people providing the capital show their teeth real fast, and it gets scary, right? It's also, you know, there's interesting and creative ways to build businesses and succeed and then raise money at much smarter valuations where you control your business, right? Versus getting cannibalized by the big pool of capital and whoever is providing it.
Yeah. They may show their teeth, but like the women I know in this who have founded businesses, like we all chew glass for breakfast. We can handle it. So they're good.
Well, I like that. I'm just speaking for myself. I get scared.
That's great. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what's next for Poseidon. Obviously, yeah, Poseidon Investment Management. It seems like you all have been doing the rounds recently. I'd love to hear more about what you're looking for into this year, moving into what will hopefully not be a horrible 2023.
What a way to launch that off.
Yeah, you're welcome, man. No recession, no...
A horrible 23. Ouch.
No, not a horrible 2023.
Yes. No. Go ahead. Well, I think cannabis is at a really interesting cross section because this is something we've talked about for years and years, and now we're finally getting to test it, is how counter-cyclical it could be. I think there's enough signs pointing to a recession on a macro level, I think, right? Is it getting to consensus that recession is here or happening? or potentially is, you know, I actually have a theory, we'll see if it plays out, that it's a double dip where Q1 and Q2 of this year were a inventory-led recession, maybe get a little head fake, and then going into a real recession, a demand-led recession next year. And that's what the Fed wants to do. But counter to that is cannabis is just a regulatory-driven growth. And so we actually have this force behind us, this tailwind, where access is just being created. So even if you have the consumer behavior, the basket may be changing, you just have an industry that's emerging and is driven by new growth opening, whether it's new states or within states, more municipalities opening, or even talking globally, right? I mean, you know, you're seeing the activity from Germany. You always hear about when, you know, there's the corollary to when Prohibition ended, you know, was in the Great Depression. Tax revenue, jobs, people are seeking these things. You could point to a lot of potential to cannabis as well. So, you know, I think there's it's potentially more muted picture, as I mentioned, just given the consumer standpoint, but there's just a lot of growth still happening because of that first time access for so many people. So from our perspective, we're building Poseidon. Poseidon's got a lot of capacity to grow a lot more. We have built infrastructure now for years to be this asset management firm focused on cannabis and hemp. You know, these are two areas that have a lot of time left in them, a lot of years of CAGR to go. So, you know, it's continuing to build up our private funds and deploying those and building up the ETF. You know, we think there's going to be the cycles of M&A come and go, right? This year was certainly a cycle low. And we think that'll start to come back again, whether that is, at least from our perspective, always with a lens towards thoughtful integration, you know, trying to build bigger businesses where you're truly thinking about what it means for companies to come together and not for the financial engineering perspective. So we do think there could be some capacity for that to start coming back next year, regardless of the capital dynamics, just because these companies are getting to a certain size where these operational efficiencies make sense and the offerings, you know, just becomes compelling to do so. And that's a good thing. It is still a very fragmented industry that's early in its life. And so these waves will come and go, but the long-term trend is just continued consolidation. So, you know, we see that in our portfolios and try to foster that. You know, Emily mentioned our team a bit. Andreas heads up M&A activities for the firm. So when these kind of opportunities come up, he jumps on that full force and provides resources directly with our companies. So, you know, we try to have these different levers in house of how we can best work with our companies, whether it's being on the boards, as we are very active with a lot of our private companies, or, you know, just trying to provide this extra support to them because resources are still pretty limited in our space. You know, it's hard to get top tier accounting or audit firms and hard to get top tier investment banks. You know, it's hard to get access to that kind of professional base still. And so if we can provide at least some of those resources to help make these companies just that much better, and that's at least, you know, that's on top of my mind. Emily, what do you think?
I think you nailed it.
Boom.
Boom.
Mic drop. I do have one follow-up. And Javier, you can wrap us up, Javier. But I got to ask. So the German legalization plan, they have since reeled in their THC limits and changed that language. Colombia, what's happening there? Are you expecting your Portcos or anybody in the space right now domestically to start taking more aggressive strides outside the U.S., or is it still going to be pretty domestic focused?
I mean, I do think it will be pretty domestic focused. There are pretty large groups that have taken stakes in the European market, in the Western European market. And, you know, I think Curaleaf being one that has the most exposure on that. I do think, you know, Colombia is something we've been involved in the past. It's a tremendous country and an amazing potential market for cultivating high quality cannabis at an extraordinarily low cost. And I would hope that, you know, we do see a global supply chain that reflects that, because if you're looking at, for example, pharmaceutical API, I can't think of a more efficient place to source it from, especially because there is GMP infrastructure down there. And, you know, at some point we'll see Mexico turn on fully. It's been pretty fragmented, and I think it's doing disservice to the country, but that's, you know, how I generally feel about legalization. But I am pretty, I'm pretty interested in it. We watch it very carefully. You know, Germany, as you know, Morgan says, they've, you know, expressed interest to make sure they're controlling it domestically, which is not surprising to Morgan or I. It's just very German way to do business. And it makes sense because they've managed to nurture a pretty strong economy. Although, as Morgan sent me an article yesterday, California just jumped up to, now the fourth largest economy in the world, which at some point, yeah, exactly. At some point when this cannabis economy gets sorted out, we should not all forget that, because I know California has kind of been bruised and battered as a cannabis economy, but we should not lose sight of the real horsepower here from a sheer population size. And also our ability to cultivate outdoors and the brand building that goes on in California. So we're not giving up on California. We just think you have to be incredibly prudent about it. But that's a sidebar. Yeah. And just to, you know, touch base on, you know, what Morgan was talking about and where we're headed with the economic climate, I already saw in Europe that people are experiencing a lot of pressure around the core. And so they are starting to exhibit recessionary behaviors in terms of their spending and their activities. And I saw also that like millennials just have reported that they're dating out less because of the cost of dating. I think all of those things tend to bode well for cannabis. And let's face it, our pricing has been declining while other pricing has been going up. And I think that we can think about what it means to, you know, enjoy your life when you're not maybe out and about and spending so much and traveling so much and enjoying more time at home. So cannabis has a real place.
All right. On-site business idea here. Let me get some investors, see if we got it. It's like HelloFresh, but with cannabis-infused meals.
Oh, hot damn.
I'm saying, somebody's probably already working on it. It's too late.
Yeah, there's already guys on bikes in New York doing that. So.
Isn't that a breeze? Touché. Yeah, that's a good point, Morgan.
Touché, awesome.
Little pizza delivery with a little extra sauce.
So. A little weedy pizza.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. Though I wouldn't buy it in New York. Not a chance.
Absolutely not. That being said, that's it for me. Javier, last to you, man. Anything on your mind here?
I think we're good. We're way over time.
No time limit for Poseidon Investment Management here. Morgan and Emily Paxia, really appreciate you both joining us. I think this is the first time that you both joined us together. It needs to happen more regularly. Your insights in the space are very valuable. And we look forward to catching up soon. We need to talk more on Biden. We'll see where this canopy news goes, but lots to dive into from here to the end of the year. But thank you all so much again for being with us.
Thank you. We always enjoy Benzinga. So thank you so much.